What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
I call it the doorway to hell. Oh my God, it does exist.
You have unleashed a creature that we have feared for more than 3,000 years.
Well, more like 25 years, but yes, Josh, we are unleashing the creature known as the Mummy.
The Brendan Fraser starring adventure film has been resurrected for its 25th anniversary, and we've got a review.
Plus, our William Wyler marathon continues with 1968's Funny Girl starring Barbara Streisand. That's ahead.
Don't you rain on my parade, Adam.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
Don't tell me not to live, just sit and putter. Life's candy and the sun's a ball of butter. Don't bring around a cloud to rain on my parade. Don't
tell me not to... Welcome to Film Spotting. We've been doing the show for a long time, Josh. Is it possible that we've never really talked about Barbara Streisand?
I don't think we have. And it was maybe 2 minutes into Funny Girl when I thought Barbara Streisand marathon probably needs to happen.
Yeah, maybe it should, because I think the most I've talked about Streisand on the show goes back to our review of Licorice Pizza and how I appreciated every scene that Bradley Cooper was in as John Peters. And he's got some great lines. Remember where he talks about how to properly pronounce her name? I hope I get it right and Bradley Cooper doesn't scold me.
That's Streisand. Right. I had forgotten about that.
Streisand.
Oh, great. Extra pressure now for our review.
Later in the show, Babs will finally get her due. I don't think I'm supposed to call her that.
No.
We'll talk
not
about
until we do a marathon, at least.
Yeah. We'll talk about 1968's Funny Girl, the fifth film in our William Wyler marathon. The movie was a Best Picture nominee and won Streisand a Best Actress Oscar. We'll also get a preview of the upcoming Chicago Critics Film Festival, which runs May 3rd through the 9th. Our friend Steve Procopi joins us for that. More info about the fest is at ChicagoCriticsFilmFestival.com. We turn now to The Mummy. Released on May 7th, 1999, the Stephen Sommers-directed film went on to become the eighth highest-grossing movie of the year and made Brendan Fraser, the goofball star of movies like George of the Jungle, Encino Man, and Airheads, haven't seen any of those, a major, if fleeting, box office draw. Set in 1926, Fraser's American adventurer Rick O'Connell is seeking treasure in the lost city of Hamunaptra, the Egyptian city of the dead. Awaiting him is the mummy of the title, a high priest who was buried alive 3,000 years earlier. Fraser isn't riding solo on this quest. He's joined by, among others, a bookish Egyptologist, are there any other kind, played by Rachel Weisz.
Did I miss something? Are we going into battle?
Lady, there's something out there. Something underneath that sand.
Yes, well, I'm hoping to find a certain artifact. A book, actually. My brother thinks there's treasure. What do you think's out there?
In a word, evil. The Bedouin and the Tuaregs believe that Hamunaptra is cursed.
Oh, look, I don't believe in fairy tales and hokum, Mr. O'Connell, but I do believe that one of the most famous books in history is buried out there, the Book of Amun-Ra. It contains within it all the secret incantations of the Old Kingdom. It's what first interested me in Egypt when I was a child. It's why I came here, sort of a life's pursuit.
And the fact that they say that it's made out of pure gold makes no never mind to you, right?
You know your history.
I know my treasure.
Adam, you joked last week about being too snobby back in 1999 to have bothered with something like The Mummy, Universal's attempt to revive a property it first launched back in 1932 with Boris Karloff in the title role. Starring Brendan Fraser and Rachel Weisz, along with Arnold Vosloo as the bandaged bad guy, 1999's The Mummy was clearly meant to be a popcorn trifle. I'll admit I had my own snobbish tendencies about such pictures back then. A young critic trying to establish my voice while at the Regional News, a weekly newspaper in the southwest suburbs of Chicago, I touted Art House Fair to my fellow suburban heathens. Hirokazu Koreeda's Afterlife made my top 10 list that year. And I would sneer at Hollywood nonsense when I felt it deserved it. in my May 13, 1999 review of The Mummy, I felt the need for some reason to take a shot at the Catherine Zeta-Jones, Sean Connery thriller Entrapment, which had recently come out, saying that its, quote, lame script and lazy direction left me wondering if Hollywood had forgotten how to crank out the kind of sleek entertainment it's always thrived on. You're not going to find that one at LarsonOnFilm.com, Adam. I had to go back.
No?
I had to go back to the print archives for it.
Come on, get an intern on that.
I continued, however, to say this about The Mummy in my enthusiastically positive review. The movie, quote, revels in the same mixture of tongue-in-cheek humor and rollicking action that drove Raiders of the Lost Ark. It remembers what makes a good romantic adventure tick. Now, personally, Adam, I feel like I'm both more and maybe less snobby now. I mean, I'm certainly more expansive in my movie tastes, but I'm also less worried about what might happen to my critical reputation if I were to stand up for silliness. What's your snob meter like these days? And how does The Mummy measure against it, especially considering you watched it for the first time for this conversation? We'll get to my impressions after revisiting it for the first time in probably 20 years. The movie is celebrating its 25th anniversary, in case you haven't been doing the math. But let's start with you. Does 2024 Adam have room for something like a light Raiders riff? Or do you wish that on this show we were giving our time to that long-discussed Corrida Marathon instead?
I definitely would prefer the Corrida Marathon. That was true before I saw The Mummy. True after I saw The Mummy. There's a very clear answer to this snobometer question. We'll see if you buy my answer by the time we get through this review, Josh, but I already kind of answered it just off the cuff. Didn't see George of the Jungle, Encino Man, Airheads back in the mid-90s or whatever. I skipped Entrapment too. I was a much bigger snob back in 99. Appropriately too, it was mostly unfounded pretentiousness because obviously, and you noted this as well, Josh, I've seen so many more movies now, and I've thought seriously about so many more movies since then. Back then, though, I didn't even give The Mummy a second thought. It looked dumb. I had no desire to see it. Fast forward now to 2024. I'm the one who suggested maybe I missed out on some fun, and we should give it some time here on the show. So obviously, I've changed. I suppose one might say I've evolved. And yes, I joked about it last week, but it wasn't really a joke. I was in full-on film school mode in 99. The inspiration for my final student movie that year came from Antonioni's Alienation trilogy. Now, the film bore no resemblance whatsoever to that inspiration. Thankfully, I can't imagine how much worse that product might have been. And I've told this story before, Josh, maybe once or twice on the show, but I'll mention it again. In 99, I remember, or I suppose it could have been late 98, I remember being at the Landmark Century Cinema. I lived here in Chicago, just three blocks away, maybe. I remember seeing a movie there, walking out, somehow not being strong enough to avoid a nice middle-aged woman who asked me to participate in some kind of focus group thing. And since it was 99, it certainly wasn't on smartphones or anything, but they somehow showed me, must have been a portable DVD player or something, they showed me the trailer for The Matrix. And I had to answer questions about it and answer how interested I was in The Matrix. And I watched it, and all I know is I said, pass. Nah, not interested. Keanu Reeves, that guy? Nope, don't need to see it. Now, fortunately, I did, even in 99, eventually see The Matrix, and I did love it. So I had enough of an open mind about that kind of action material, Josh, that I was maybe initially too dismissive of. Now, just because I'm more open-minded now doesn't mean I'm going to give every popcorn trifle, is that what you called it? I'm going to give every popcorn trifle a pass. I'm not obligated to enjoy every blockbuster I see as much as I wish I did. And so it does really disappoint me to report that I'm going to disappoint you.
I knew this was going to happen.
and say that I experienced enough of The Mummy's charms to understand why so many cinephiles are generally high on it, but I'm not one of them.
Mm.
Among those charms, Frasier and Weiss. The sexual heat they exude in this film is off the charts. I get why people look back on this movie fondly and why so many people, especially maybe teenagers at the time, particularly enjoyed it. And I know you're going to disagree with me on this, but they somehow for me, and maybe it is because of how trifling it is, how whimsical the film is, how it does certainly emphasize the comedy over the romance here. They never quite exude enough sexual tension as a couple to really bring me into it. And going back to our review of Roadhouse recently, both Roadhouses, I disavow any talk of eye twinkling. I don't even know what eye twinkling means or how an actor or actress goes about doing it. But if I did put any stock in it, I'd probably point to Frasier's performance here. He just consistently puts a little extra mustard on the hot dog as the swashbuckling American rogue. And I think the film needs that sensibility. It needs his charisma here. He pulls off the movie star thing as Rick O'Connell. You can probably feel that there's a butt.
I mean, and this has sounded like a pretty good time to me so far.
I know, but
even the sexual tension, it doesn't work for you, but it's off the charts. So I don't know what it takes for you, man. But
again, individually, I wanted a little more as a couple, Josh. I don't really want to start here. And honestly, we can dovetail into whatever you want to talk about in terms of praising this movie. But in terms of the conversations we can have around this film, about the only thing I can maybe speak to with any depth whatsoever, and I had no sense of this whatsoever going into the film, and it's not remotely a fun topic to discuss. Set aside even the casting choices, all I can really wrestle with when it comes to this movie is the mummy insanely xenophobic, insanely racist, or both? Because I do understand that there's a difference, and I had to send myself off to Google today, Josh, to really get a handle on this and make sure that I didn't misspeak. I want to say that it's just insanely xenophobic in the way it so delightfully seems to enjoy making anyone who isn't American or English look kind of monstrous. But the thing is, it seems to believe that because of their foreignness, and I'm speaking here foreignness in relation to the filmmakers and to our heroes, it seems to feel like they're actually lesser. They smell, they're lascivious, they're certainly not above a little sexual coercion, they're avaricious. And if you happen to be a foreigner who doesn't exhibit any of these traits, well, you're either completely ineffectual at best, at worst, you're completely disposable. And I want to be clear, it isn't just a matter for me of viewing a 1999 movie through a 2024 lens and finding it politically incorrect or whatever. What I struggle with here is that disposability. Think about the scene where the mob gets turned into Imhotep's slaves, basically. I get it. They're his slaves now. They're under his control. They're a threat to our heroes. I understand that our heroes need to survive, and we're rooting for them to survive. They have no way out, it seems. But not only do they have zero apprehension about mowing them all down with a car, the movie portrays it like it's a rollicking good time. And I made a similar argument against The Matrix when we talked about it most recently on the show and back in 99. So I'm being consistent here anyway in terms of my point of view. For me, Josh, the tone, I guess, is the word where it seems off-putting to me, where you can really look at it too, and it ties together with this notion of the movie xenophobia that rubbed me the wrong way, the Benny character.
What a surprise! My good friend, you're alive! I was so very, very worried.
Well, if it ain't my little buddy Benny, I think I'll kill you.
Think of my children.
You don't have any children.
Someday I might.
Shut up. So you're the one who...
I read a wiki today trying to get a handle on what his origins are or where he's supposed to be from. Supposedly he's like Hungarian, but he's played by an American, and he seems to have all these traits of other nationalities wrapped up in his character. He's definitely not American or English, let's say that. And I know how silly. The movie treats him otherwise. But by the end, I actually find him, I think the movie wants us to feel this way based on that relationship between him and Rick and how he keeps coming back in the film. I found him endearing by the end of the movie. And then to have one of the final notes of the film be, let's watch Benny get entombed and eaten alive by bugs. And isn't he the guy who told us earlier how much he hates bugs? So now he's getting like the worst fate you could possibly imagine. There's just so much punishment against that character at the end of the film that didn't match, again, how I felt about him, how I thought the movie wanted me to feel about him throughout. It seemed unnecessarily mean. The movie itself seemed often unnecessarily mean to me, Josh.
Yeah, I don't think there's a mean bone in this movie's body, but I will say the cultural insensitivity that you're describing, and that's how it registered to me on this watch, was one of the disappointments in the revisit for me. And, you know, it's something I wish I had picked up on in 99 and maybe called out a little bit more back then. It's definitely a weakness. I don't think it's you know, any sort of strategized messaging that the movie is trying to put across. And I think it's probably it's worse than saying it's of its time. Yet at the same time, it's not all that distinct from things we were seeing around then. And even in something honestly like Raiders of the Lost Ark, which has this element as well. So yeah, definitely overall something that was disappointing. But I a word you use there I want to return to and put it in a different context, lascivious. I think, you know, you're underselling the Weiss, Frasier, both individual and as a comic romantic team, for me, is what really made this work. Rachel Weiss here, I mean, somehow, and I don't know how, you don't want to break something like this down. It's like comedy, but she could be talking about ancient history for 5 minutes here, and she makes that lascivious just yeah. on her own in conversation. And the way she uses her eyebrow, an eyebrow here and there throughout the movie, is like a potent thermonuclear weapon. It's outrageous what she's bringing to this. And Frasier has a different sort of but equally potent charisma in this movie. I think he's maybe a little bit miscast as the tough guy. Those scenes where he's sort of the more standard action hero. Okay, you know, he hits his marks. It's fine. But no, it's this wisecracking guy who's just yeah. enough of a twist mm-hmm. on what Harrison Ford brings in his action roles. Something like the moment early on when we meet this early form of the mummy, and the mummy lets out this horrible scream at them, this threatening scream. And Frasier, whether it was scripted or not, just responds by screaming back to see, you know, this big hulking guy, tough guy like that, mm-hmm. make that choice. That's just an example of how the mummy is playfully undercutting almost all of its big moments that does set it apart from, I would say, even trifles that makes it a little smarter, a little sharper, doing things like that. And even as a team, you know, for me, maybe a favorite bit, which involves not a lot between them, but again, it's just this interplay, is when Rick and Evelyn are hiding behind a wall, they're being shot at, and we see the bullet holes in the wall, and Evelyn just kind of yanks him back just in time and makes the space, and then three more bullet holes come right where he was standing. And again, it's there. It's how they handle, it's a great visual gag, right? Mm-hmm. But then it's also how they just kind of handle the acknowledgement of that together. They are so good in this movie. Mm-hmm. And it carries just a ton of it for me. And even Benny, you know, yes, he is absolutely a problematic character. Benny is played by Kevin J. O'Connor, and I do think this is a pretty sharp comedic performance on its own, if you are willing to set aside some of those issues, which we shouldn't. But he has that moment again where the mummy is coming after him, and he yanks out a crucifix, right? And the mummy just doesn't even pause. It doesn't do anything. So then he digs into his shirt and pulls out, I forget, some other religious symbol, and ends up with a Star of David. And just going through those one by one is another way this movie takes a slightly different tack to a scene we've seen a million times before. And enough of that happens throughout The Mummy that in 1999, it made me sit up and say, okay, this is something different and laudable compared to a run-of-the-mill action romantic comedy. And I think it still stands out that way now. I think it does. I think it's worth celebrating as a Hollywood exception when we're used to drowning in the rule.
I said I thought I experienced enough of its charms to understand why people like you and others do go for this movie. And many of the scenes and moments you're citing are exactly those charms, especially that scene where there's, even though the camera is steady, that's kind of the point, right? In that moment where we see the three gunshots and the way she just pulls him back from the frame a little bit, it's very clever. And those touches are probably what elevate this above, Josh, maybe some of the other junk I was skipping back in 1999. It wasn't enough for me, obviously, overall with the film. And I think it is also about what it all builds to and the narrative itself and how much potential I honestly thought it had, especially with all the time it dedicates to the lore surrounding The Mummy and allowing us to understand the relationship between Imhotep and his lover and the punishment he gets. It really establishes the stakes, okay? Unfortunately, I don't feel like it follows through on that at all. And I think where the movie misfires a little bit, Josh, I think it could have done so much more with that Imhotep character. And what I mean is done so much more in terms of the tension where, of course, we don't like him as much as we like our heroes. And we don't really want him to win, but it'd be nice if we felt pulled a little bit more in that direction. Because even as poorly a job as the movie does with it, I still felt it a little bit, enough to feel like, man, what a miss here for them not to make this character more compelling. The part they could have developed more is I did almost find myself kind of thinking, this guy's been through a lot. They were in love. Yes, they're bad people. They murdered the Pharaoh. That's not great. And they did it in a completely calculated way. It's not like they were just caught and it was self-defense. I saw that, right, as all part of their plan. Unfortunately, they get caught and then he does face this eternal punishment. But he faces such a punishment when he's alive and then mummified in 3,000 years. He has this chance to be fully resurrected and to be reunited with the woman he loves. On its own, it could have the makings of its own kind of compelling love story to mirror the one we get with Rick and Evie. But at the end of the film, the way we see in that final climactic showdown, the way we see that character behave, he operates, Josh, like someone who just has no sense of urgency whatsoever. Like he's out just running some errands on a Saturday morning. You count up almost every shot of him, of that character, of Imhotep, in the final 20 minutes of this movie. And I guarantee you 80% of them, if not more, are medium to close-up shots of him standing still, looking sort of like he's in a Keystone Cops movie, like the villain going, why is that happening? He just looks utterly lost and he's not doing anything.
Well, he's exercising his powers. He's enjoying his newfound powers.
They're getting the upper hand on him with everything they do. And I just got so bored of watching this character that should have been so terrifying. And I don't mean in a horror movie kind of way, though the movie could have leaned maybe more into that as well. I just mean in terms of the powers he has and what he is trying to accomplish and the weight he has had to accomplish it and how much he is obsessed with and loves that woman to be that close to it. And then this character just basically stands there at the end and watches these goofballs, you know, go through the motions in upending him. It just was It lost me. I didn't have anything invested in it, Josh.
I think you're over-dramatizing those scenes. I mean, that sequence is also where you get the awesome image of the sandstorm he conjures up and the face, his own face coming out
before it,
in the sandstorm.
Yes.
So I don't know. I thought the prologue you mentioned, I think, is one of the movie's strengths, that we get this 5 to 10 minutes of what, 2,000 to 3,000
years
ago, I think it
is.
Yeah. So I think that's one of the strengths and does carry through to the end. Not that I'm all that invested by Imhotep's, you know, plan. I think he becomes something more of a comic figure as well. There's that great bit where throughout this movie, there are these flesh-eating beetles that show up, right, here and there. And at one point, this is before Imhotep has fully formed, so he's kind of still this half-corpse decaying, and so his cheek is open. And one of those beetles crawls into it. And from what we've seen before, it's like, oh, this thing's going to eat him alive or something. And what does he do? No, he just like crunches down on it with his teeth and swallows it. Another just nice little aside, a touch. But I did want to ask you about the special effects, because I think the face in the sandstorm I mentioned holds up. Reading my original review, this is just interesting in terms of like, how far digital effects even have come. We complain about them quite a bit, but I was so impressed by the effects in this in my 1999 review. And I'm watching again now via a great transfer. You know, it's going to look as possibly as good as it can. And I'm thinking, oh, wow, this is like a lot of it is a little bit like the soup Marvel has been ladling out to us these last 4 or 5 films, where it's not as crisp, and that's probably okay. I mean, we're talking 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. And so I was just wondering how that aspect struck you, because for me, I was a little disappointed remembering of how blown away I was by it then.
Interesting.
Even though I'm factoring in the passage of time.
Sure. Yeah. And I don't have anything to compare it to, unlike you. I'm just going off of what I see, and I don't feel like it had a major impact on my enjoyment of the film one way or another. There are some practical effects, certainly, that you can see in different scenes that I think are pretty effective, even if they're maybe not quite as believable. And then when they lean into the CGI, there are scenes where you can really tell it. It's undeniable.
Yeah.
A little bit distracting, for sure. Again, maybe we have to allow that it was 1999, but I definitely felt as if it was noticeably bad, Josh, in several scenes, while, again, not really holding it that much against the movie.
Fair enough. Yeah. So I would say that the cultural insensitivity we covered, you know, probably The Mummy has been knocked down for me a little bit on this revisit. But overall, I do think it's, you know, it's something to take another look at that has earned its reputation and just look at as an example of something Hollywood does so often and doesn't often do well.
Yeah, I think that's totally fair. I think if you can get in sync with its comedic rhythm, as you definitely did, and I was a little more hit or miss with, then that can override a lot of other concerns with the film and make it certainly entertaining. I like John Hannah. I like that character. I like the dynamic between the three of them as the brother in those scenes. Again, going back to a character who is not one of those three heroes. And for me, this just falls into that storytelling aspect, Josh, that I just think is a little bit lazy with the film and how it doesn't quite live up to those high stakes that it establishes so early in the film. That group that has devoted their lives, they've devoted their entire lives to ensuring that this creature is never released.
Yeah, they really drop the ball, don't they?
And they're so terrible at it, and not in a funny way. They're just terrible at it, to the point where at one point they say, I mean, this might be the funniest line in the movie, even though it's unintentional. They have this big battle, and then they finally stop fighting, and they say, "You can't be here.
We'll give you till tomorrow.
How about 24 hours to clear out your
it's
stuff?"
It's totally a joke.
Does that work for you guys? Yeah. We'll just wait.
It's absolutely a joke.
Okay.
Yeah. You got to get on the movie's wavelength. And I will say, as ridiculous as bad at their jobs as they are, Odette Fair as their leader,
Yes.
Looks pretty good sitting on that horse. I mean, it's,
looks
it's
so good.
Just like, we're talking, we're going to get to Omar Sharif, but I'm definitely getting Omar Sharif vibes in Lawrence of Arabia from some
too.
Of the composition with him. So that's fine.
Too.
He can be as bad as he wants at his job, as long as he looks like that.
Well, I think you can say that about maybe Frasier and Weiss too in this film, but that just speaks to me, actually, your point about that performer, that just speaks to why I wish the movie actually did a little bit more with him and made him a little bit more interesting of a character. I knew if not the snob, I was going to come off as the scold here that just doesn't know how to have a good time with people, you know, goofing a little bit, Josh, but it's maybe not my tempo.
Let's hold out hope you had fun with Funny Girl.
We'll see. Good tease for later in our show. The Mummy is currently available VOD. If you see it and agree or disagree with us, you can email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
There are a couple of very easy ways you can help this show, whether you're a longtime listener or just finding us. Would you take a minute and give us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify? You can do it right now while you're listening. It's very easy, and every new rating or review helps an independently produced show like ours reach new listeners. We got this review in recently from some guy in Indiana. Adam and Josh are great. I hope the show lasts forever. They're both articulate and analytical, but never stuffy. There's a good sense of humor throughout, which helps keep things light. They have a real appreciation for film history and have a nice balance of new reviews and classic discussion. I've been listening on and off for about a decade now. One of these years, I hope to make a live show. Future Madness Ideas. Best animated films. Best international films. Best science fiction films. Adam's top 32 on one side versus Josh's 32 on the other. Ooh.
Yeah.
That's
now,
a pretty good idea.
Now we're talking. My eyes lit up when I read that earlier today, too. To go back just for a second, though, real appreciation for film history. Does 1999's The Mummy count at this point? It's pretty old.
Thank goodness some guy in Indiana put this review in before he heard you talk about The Mummy.
Yeah, no kidding. I read this earlier today, and my initial thought was I didn't quite pay attention to the ellipsis after best science fiction films and thought he was just saying, like, as a blanket concept, Adam's top 32 on one side versus Josh's 32 on the other. And I just went wild with the possibilities, thinking it could be about anything. I think that's what he meant. Okay. So that was my thought, Josh. We could spend all of our future madnesses just devoted to different topics where it's my 32 versus your 32.
We could.
But then when I went back and looked at it, I did wonder, since there is that ellipsis and the connection to science fiction films, maybe that's what he's saying. He's tying it to science
possible.
Fiction.
But more intriguing is my top 32 of all time versus your top 32. The unfortunate thing is, like, it may not sound like it to regular listeners,
overlap.
But we would have a fair amount of overlap.
Of course we would. Yeah, no, I get it. But we do really like the concept, and we are definitely not throwing it away. Some guy in Indiana. Another way you can support the show is to join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com. We would like to welcome a new member whose name, Josh, I did not get a definitive pronunciation on, even though we met him. We met him at the LA live show. I emailed too late prior to recording. It is Mark Mullicane. That's how it looks anyway. Mark Mullicane. He's in the Bay Area. He started listening around 2010 when Maddie was still doing the show. He found us through iTunes. And in terms of an episode that really stands out as a favorite, the top 20 films of the 2010s is one for Mark. He also likes the director retrospectives we did during the pandemic, Nolan Campion. Reviews we got wrong. Okay. Adam on Priscilla, Josh on Guardians 3. Yeah.
Hey, you know what, Mark, if you're going to defend Priscilla, I will give you Guardians 3.
Letterboxd 4 favorites from Mark: Metropolis, Vertigo, Ron, and Blue from Kieslowski.
Very strong.
A random favorite film or filmmaker: Verhoeven's Starship Troopers, a movie he credits with being a cinephile, Rashomon, another Kurosawa pick, and finally a favorite book about movies or movie making: Peter Biskin's Easy Riders, Raging Bulls.
Thank you, Mark, for all that, and thanks for joining the family. In addition to keeping us doing what we're doing, Mark's support comes with perks. He gets to listen early and ad-free, gets a weekly newsletter, and, of course, access to our monthly bonus shows. Can't wait to record our next one. We are doing a British movies draft with the winner of the listener bracket for 1950s Film Spotting Madness, Ricky Kendall. We're recording that in just a couple of days here. It should be a blast. Complete access to the archive of shows also comes with being a Film Spotting family member. You can find out more information and sign up at filmspottingfamily.com.
Thursday started out with a bang. Heat, humidity, moonlight, all the elements in place for a long weekend. I was good at my job. There were periods when my hands moved with the speed and skill beyond me.
How long have you been doing this?
5 years.
Wow, you must have seen some things, huh?
And that's from Martin Scorsese's Bringing Out the Dead, which, like The Mummy, Adam, came to theaters in 1999. Even better than The Mummy, if you can believe that. You probably agree with that now that you've seen The Mummy.
I do.
While Bringing Out the Dead, it's one of the titles getting an anniversary release as part of the Chicago Critics Film Festival, which starts May 3 at the Music Box.
This is the 11th edition of the festival, which brings the best of the festival circuit to Chicago, including many films getting their Chicago premieres. Joining us now to talk about this year's lineup, as he usually does, longtime friend of the show, Steve Procopi. Steve is one of the fest's programmers. Welcome back to Film Spotting, Steve. Great to have you.
It's great to talk to you guys again. Thank you for having me.
So here's what we've done. We've set you up with what seems like a simple task, but with all of these great titles, I'm sure was actually quite difficult, especially being one of the people responsible for selecting all of these titles and these guests. Not every film has a special guest attached, but the three you're going to mention, I think, do. Mm-hmm. So we want to get your take here. We're imagining some people listening. They're in the Chicago area or maybe nearby, thinking about making the trek in to the Music Box and seeing some of these films that they have heard us talk about, or maybe they've seen on social media. If you had to pick out three titles to highlight, we want to hear what those picks would be. And I think you're going to start us off with the opening night film.
One of them, yeah. I should mention, I literally just came from something where someone was cursing me because there were too many good titles in the festival overall. And I'm not just yeah. saying that. He was legitimately mad. He's like, I wasn't going to come every day. But now I think I have to.
Now he has to.
Yeah.
Because good problem every day to have. Something great. Okay, so the opening night film is Sing Sing. That's on Friday, May 3rd at 6:30. It's a new film from A24, and it's about a group of men who are incarcerated at Sing Sing Prison, including a guy named Divine G, who was played by recent Oscar nominee Coleman Domingo. He's in jail for a crime he didn't commit. He's not just saying that. That's true. And he kind of finds purpose in acting in a theater group. I don't know if he created the group or it was already there when he got there. I'm not sure they established that, but he does this along with some other men who are incarcerated in this story of resilience and humanity and sort of the transformative power of art. It has most of the actors in the film, with a couple of exceptions, are all people who were in this program in prison. So like I mentioned, Coleman Domingo's in it. There's a guy named Clarence Mousen, who I believe is one of the prisoners, Paul Racy, and then a guy named Sean Johnson. All of those people are actually going to be at the screening, not Coleman Domingo, though, but all the other actors, as well as the director named Greg Quadar. It's going to be a very crowded stage after that screening. But we are so excited that A24 is just throwing all these guys at us, because the stories these guys are going to have about not just this program, and we see them put on a production of Hamlet. And so to watch prisoners who know nothing about Shakespeare have to learn the Shakespearean languages and rhythms, as well as find some meaning in the play for them. Every one of them has an individual journey. It's fascinating. Might be the best thing I've ever seen Coleman Domingo do. It's a tremendous, tremendous film.
That's high praise. Yeah, Domingo is great. I know, Steve, another one of your picks is Babe. So I'd love to have you talk a little bit about that. This is from director Pamela Adlon, a comedy she made. And is Adlon going to be one of the people coming in?
She is the only person coming in for Babes. Yes, she is, of course, the creator and star of and director and writer of the series Better Things that was on FX, which I think is such a great show. This is Saturday, May 4th at 6:45, and she's not in the film. The film actually stars Alana Glazer, who is a woman named Eden, and her best friend Dawn, played by Michelle Glazer actually wrote the film as well. They grew up together in New York, so we sort of see them as kids at the beginning, and then they grew up together, and they have definitely grown up close, but very in very different phases of their lives when we meet them as adults. And one, Eden is a little more carefree and has a lot of one-night stands, and Dawn is married, and so, but after a one-night stand, Eden gets pregnant, and so the film, it is both sort of serious about the complexities of female friendship, as well as pregnancy. It is also kind of graphic when it comes to some of the pitfalls of pregnancy, and it's very funny and very heartwarming. And yes, we say like Pamela Adlon is going to be there. It's interesting because I don't think Adlon and Glazer have that similar styles of comedy. So it's kind of fun to watch a film where they both found like a middle ground that I think is almost a whole different kind of comedy, but it's about friendship and it's messy and unpredictable, you know, about the challenges of both adulthood and parenthood. So Pamela Adlon will be there. I am beyond excited for her to be there because she's one of my heroes.
Great stuff so far. You have one title left, Steve. Which one is it?
So I'm going to pick one that probably no one has heard of. And it was something I saw at Sundance by a new director named India Donaldson called Good One. It's on Wednesday, May 8th at 7 o'clock. It's insightful. It's piercing. It's about a 17-year-old girl named Sam, played by Lily Kalias, who embarks on a three-day backpacking trip in the Catskills with her father, played by James LeGros, and his oldest friend, played by Danny McCarthy. The two men kind of settle into this sort of quarrel, like sort of joking, quarrelsome, brotherly dynamic, and it kind of leaves her just sort of shrugging her shoulders and rolling her eyes at them. But they also the two men are also sort of airing some very long-held grievances. But Sam, of course, is quiet, and she just sort of observes them and wise beyond her years. And she's just trying to enjoy nature. And then at a certain point in this camping trip, I don't want to give too much away, but certain lines are crossed. Sam's trust is betrayed on a certain level. Tensions kind of ramp up very quickly. And really what it comes down to is it's a story about, it's that moment in every kid's life where they realize their parents are flawed, that they start to find reasons to distance themselves from their parents, some of them. And it does end up feeling very universal in that respect when the child-parent bond is tested in this way. And I got to say, I don't know if I've ever seen Lily Kalias in anything before, but she is the standout here without a doubt. And it's nice to see James LeGros. And so I just saw him in another movie recently, and I was like, oh, I'm glad he's still around. I kind of remember coming up with him in the 90s in the indie scene. Mm-hmm. And this is definitely has that indie feel to it. It's mostly just talking and walking. So, but it really does. Everyone I know who saw it just got sucked into it because you're not quite sure where it's going. And yeah, so India Donaldson, the director and I believe writer, will be there on Wednesday, the 8th of May.
A great lineup and a great lineup of guests, obviously. Some titles that we've either mentioned already on this show or mentioned last week, in addition to these three, maybe the film I'm most excited to see in terms of a new film, I saw The TV Glow, Jane Schoenbrunn, a Golden Brick nominee for We're All Going to the World's Fair. The anniversary titles, in addition to Bringing Out the Dead, seeing the 1994 Little Women on the big screen would be a treat. And then it turns out I'm looking at the list, Stephen, there is a title I have seen and I've actually recommended on the show. It played at Sundance, the new documentary from Benjamin Ree, who did The Painter and the Thief, which we were both fans of here on the show, Josh. At the time, it was just called Ebelin. Its new title, right, I guess, is The Remarkable Life of Ebelin. Encourage people to see that on Sunday, May 5th.
It got recent. The title got changed by Netflix when they bought it, I think. And it is, if any movie we have this year is guaranteed to have you sobbing on the way out, it is this one. Yeah, it is remarkable.
Okay, so my last little question for you, Steve.
Yeah.
I'm not crazy, right? It was intentional that you programmers in your cleverness bookended the festival with two titles that have characters, non-traditional actors, the characters, non-traditional actors performing Shakespeare? Not an accident?
Sure. Why not? We have three titles with the word dead in it. And that wasn't on purpose either. So
okay. Well, I was looking at Sing Sing and Ghostlight. And if you're curious about more Shakespeare.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely. I love them both. And then Ghostlight is a local production. And we've had these filmmakers here as well. They did a film a couple of years ago called St. Francis that we opened with, I think, the year it played. And both the filmmakers will be there. And Jane Schoenbrunn will also be there with I Saw the TV Glow, which I just rewatched today. And it's just as good as I remember it. I saw it at Sundance. And yeah.
Can't wait for that one.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, as always, Steve, for your insights.
Thank you both.
Yeah. Thanks, Steve. We'll see you at the fest.
All right.
More information about that fest is at ChicagoCriticsFilmFestival.com. Josh, let's turn now to a film that isn't playing the Chicago Critics Film Fest, but did play last fall's Chicago International Film Festival. It won the Fest Audience Choice Award. It's called We Grow Now, a coming-of-age film set in Chicago's Cabrini Green neighborhood in the early 90s. It was directed by Minhal Bog, and it's in theaters now. Bog has made two previous features going back to 2016. She's new to us, though, Josh. Does We Grow Now fit the profile of one of our Golden Brick nominees?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, a lot of the nominees are feature debuts, but as you said, Bag is new to us, and so that counts, and it definitely has a distinct vision. We Grow Now, and it was particularly interesting to me just thinking about the time and place. You know, as you mentioned, Adam, early 90s, 92, in Cabrini Green, and so growing up in the suburbs of Chicago around that time, the public perception, or at least my blinkered perception, thanks to, I would say, like the hysterical news reports we would be getting about Cabrini Green, and even movies I saw like Candyman, which I do like, but definitely plays with the specter of crime and danger in Cabrini Green homes. You know, the perception was just of like violent crime and societal decay. Like it was like Mad Max Thunderdome over there. And so what this movie is trying to do, and by, we should note, Chicago raised as well, is to offer a counter, like this very artful corrective to that perception by focusing on these two boys played by Blake Cameron James and Gian Knight Ramirez, young boys who are best friends and live in one of the project's high-rise buildings. They're raised by loving, hardworking families. And a lot of the movie just captures them at play. These irrepressible images of these two boys at play. The movie opens with them dragging an abandoned mattress from a high floor in the high rise out to the ground, where they throw it on a pile of other mattresses so they can kind of launch themselves onto it like they're flying. And so there's a lot of imagery like that. I would also say that this movie is not naive to the realities of living in Cabrini Green at that time. As the drama goes on, we see the increased crime. We see police harassment that the residents face. We see some of the discriminatory housing policies that close in on these families. So it definitely recognizes that. But what it wants to foreground, again, is the joyful and resilient humanity of these characters. So I think that's really important. It reminded me of another Chicago set movie we've talked about, Adam, Cooley High, in this balance of joy and positivity, but also recognizing reality. Visually, there's a lot of the, I would call it the angelic nostalgia of Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life. And at the same time, because of its setting, it pays attention to the hard scrabble reality of these kids' play, which reminded me of Charles Burnett's Killer of Sheep, which includes a lot of sequences of kids playing, if I'm not mistaken, in the Watts area of Los Angeles. So a lot of really important influences going into this film, while it does manage to find its own voice as well. And it is playing right now, I believe, still in Chicago and hopefully available in other cities. If you're not able to catch it right now, hopefully as it gets a digital release, listeners will have a chance to see it then.
One I missed at the festival last year, very curious to see it, especially now based on that recommendation. Next week here on the show, it's our first show in May. So what better time to do a summer movie preview? And yes, we're thinking about reusing the approach we took to our annual movie preview back in January. I'm going to let you do the honors, Josh.
Okay. I don't know if I remember how to pronounce this. I believe it was Folie à Deux, and this will be part deux.
It
Folie
is.
À deux,
Folie à Deux,
part deux.
Part deux.
Okay.
We're pitting upcoming releases against each other. We're going to see where our expectations fall. You can contribute to that summer movie preview by voting in the current film spotting poll. You could also, you know, submit a matchup. We'll take the death match if you want to give it to us. But here's the poll question. No reboots, no prequels, no reheats, no sequels. Choose just one summer 2024 film. We gave them, Josh, the options of The Bike Riders, directed by Jeff Nichols, Austin Butler in that, along with Tom Hardy and Jodie Comer, Richard Linklater's Hitman, Jane Schoenbrunn's I Saw the TV Glow, Janet Planet from Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright Annie Baker. Kind of Kindness is in the mix. Another one from Yorgos Lanthimos with Emma Stone and Willem Dafoe. Jesse Plemons also co-stars. Or if you don't like those, I guess we're going to let you choose other and write in whichever film coming out between May 1 and Labor Day, basically. That's kind of how we think of summer. You can write that in. We'll consider it. We'll see how the results all play out. We'll share those results and your comments on next week's show as part of that preview. You can find that poll on the main page of filmspotting.net.
Quick note about what they're up to over at our sister podcast, The Next Picture Show. It is part two of the Alex Garland's Catastrophic Visions pairing. Cheery stuff. They are talking about Garland's Ex Machina alongside the Garland scripted 28 Days Later. That one, one of my favorite horror movies, is directed by Danny Boyle. That's The Next Picture Show. Comes out every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts. Well, it is time now for the return of Massacre Theater.
Is it?
Some tried to kill it, but like the mummy, it just came back, resurrected. Yeah. It is the part of the show where we perform a scene and you get a chance to win a film spotting prize. Several weeks back, we massacred this scene.
You wouldn't have that problem with a V8.
Boys, all they care about is who's got the biggest engine.
I'm a guy. It's in my DNA. So y'all race with these things, huh? Cute little toys.
You know, I almost didn't recognize you without your slippers on.
Don't you mean Wabaki? Neela, right?
You're a quick learner.
So where are you from, anyway?
Here.
No, I mean, not where you live. Where'd you come from?
Does it really matter where I'm from?
That was Natalie Kelly and Lucas Black in 2006's Fast and Furious. Which one, Adam?
Tokyo Drift. Third.
Nice.
Yeah.
Impressive. Tokyo Drift was written by Chris Morgan and directed by Justin Lin. That massacre was part of a show back in February when we reviewed Wim Wenders' Perfect Days and shared our top five Tokyo movies. So why that scene from Tokyo Drift?
Here's Aaron Neuwirth in Laguna Hills, California. The answer is, of course, The Fast and the Furious. Tokyo Drift, a top three entry in the franchise easily. I didn't know they stopped at three. And the first entry from director Justin Lin. The obvious connection is the Tokyo location. And given how this was the answer for Massacre Theater, it speaks to why it was not featured on either of your top five lists. Because, look, I like Stray Dog as much as the next guy. But who can deny the power of Bow Wow in his Green Hulk car or getting the presence of Sonny Chiba during a climactic drift race down one of those Tokyo-adjacent mountain passes?
I can deny it, Aaron. I can deny it.
Yeah, that was us. I think we denied it. Other connections I could see for this week's answer. I suppose the estranged nature between Lucas Black's Sean and his father speaks to the estrangement shown in Perfect Days between Hirayama and his own relatives. Yeah, we weren't going there, Aaron. If you really want to go deep, a crucial part of Tokyo Drift is the way Natalie Kelly's Neela shows Sean the beauty of observing the city, emulated in a sequence overlooking a busy crosswalk, which is naturally similar to Hirayama's observations taking place throughout the film, whether he snaps a picture or not. Glad to chime in regarding this vital part of the Fast and Furious franchise, especially in relation to Wim Wenders' excellent drama. Thanks for the show, as always.
Thanks for all the good work, Aaron. You did. That was some expert digging, I have to say.
Yeah.
We also heard from Michael in San Antonio. I am still chuckling thinking about that performance. Furthermore, I am nominating Josh for the annual Dick Van Dyke Award for Bad Accents.
Yeah.
Michael, I'm insulted, and yet I accept your nomination.
Why don't you reach into the film spotting hat, Josh? They've had like 4 months to enter. Go ahead and reach in. It's not so brimming. Not as many fans out there of Tokyo Drift as clearly Aaron is. Tell us who this week's winner is.
A familiar name, Ken Link,
yeah,
in Flagstaff, Arizona.
so familiar. I was sure he's won Massacre Theater before, but maybe not. He's just been entering a while. Congratulations, finally. Ken Link in Flagstaff, Arizona, email us feedback@filmspotting.net. We'll set you up with your very own Film Spotting t-shirt or a tote bag, or you could get that Film Spotting family membership if you're not already part of that group.
Would that it were so simple.
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 Oh dear boy, why do you say that? Why do you say twer?
Well, you should say it like I said it.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and it's not fair to criticize producer Sam for making this choice when I didn't suggest anything, nor did I weigh in on this choice in advance of sitting here now and recording. So you can completely dismiss all of this, but I think you picked a scene. Tell me I'm wrong. I think you picked a scene that you would only recognize if one of us does impeccable voice mimicry. Otherwise, I don't know that there's almost anything about it that gives the movie away.
That's probably correct. There are connections, I will say. There are connections.
Yes, so, connections.
You know, careful, thoughtful listeners like Aaron, you know, will probably figure that out. But yeah, a lot of this is going to fall on probably me. I don't know that you, your role.
No.
Although I'll say this about your role. You have an allergy to ums, which is very professional of you and much appreciated by all listeners. You gotta lean into the ums here, my friend.
They're not in my script. You want me to improvise the ums?
Yes.
I can't do that. Yeah. That would be like real acting.
I feel like there were many ums that aren't in the script for us.
Okay. We'll
throw
we'll
a few
see
in.
What I can do.
Just throw a few in.
Yeah, I'll try.
And there's no retakes.
I'll let my hair down.
There's no retakes. This is, you know, a one-take thing. You can't back up.
Okay, I'm ready. I started off. You're going to give me the action.
And action.
Why did you come back here?
Your friend brought me back here. I'm glad he did. Can I buy you a drink?
Oh, I got to change, and I've got paint in my hair, and...
Oh, that's not your real hair?
No, my real hair's like your color, but
Oh, okay.
I paint it with this makeup.
I love to see what that looks like. I'll wait for you.
Yeah. Okay. Sure. You want to wait? I'll come and have a drink with you. Sure.
And scene. I know one thing. These two are doomed, based on that interaction.
I know.
It is not going to go well.
Josh, all the credit. All flowers to you for taking that on. I do think maybe you sounded a little bit more like a character out of Deliverance than the actor you were trying to portray. But
I mean, I think what I was going for was the Muppet version of Deliverance.
Mm.
Did I hit that?
Yeah. Yeah.
And now that, did, Josh. And now that I've horrified everyone's dreams for the evening.
If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title and your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, May 6th. We'll select the winner randomly from all the correct entries and announce it in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I don't think Disney's going to make that anytime soon.
No.
You know, you've probably heard this very often that it's boring, but I had to come back to tell you how much I enjoyed what you did.
It's not so boring. You'd be surprised how boring it isn't.
You're going to be a big star someday, Miss...
Bryce, Fanny Bryce.
Fanny Bryce. I look for it in lights.
What'd you say your name was?
Nick Arnstein.
Nicky Arnstein, Nicky Arnstein. What a beautiful, beautiful name.
That's Barbara Streisand and Omar Sharif in 1968's Funny Girl. It's the fifth of six films in our William Wyler marathon. Loosely based on the early 20th century career of Jewish comedian, singer, and actress Fanny Bryce, the film was an adaptation of a hugely successful stage musical also starring Streisand. The film was nominated for 8 Oscars, including Best Picture, and it won one. Best Actress for Streisand, which in a rare tie she shared with Katharine Hepburn.
Over his 40-year directing career, Wyler had made almost every kind of picture, big and small, comedies, dramas, westerns, literary adaptations, war films, crime films, noirs, and on. But he never made a musical. He was also losing his hearing. He would go on to make only one more film after Funny Girl, 1970's The Liberation of L.B. Jones. Funny Girl was a smash. It was the top-grossing film of 1968 and made Streisand, in her debut film role, a huge star.
When we meet Streisand's Fanny Bryce at the beginning of the film, she's already a success, arriving at the theater in a luxurious fur coat with a fantastic matching hat, I must add. The rest of the film takes place in flashback with a plucky, irreverent Bryce trying to break into show business. That break takes place the same night she meets her future husband, the charming and successful gambler and entrepreneur, Nicky Arnstein, played by Sharif. But as Bryce's star rises, Arnstein's begins to fade, and what started as more of a musical rom-com becomes a more complicated musical drama. Adam, as you noted, this was the veteran Wyler's first musical, and while it is epic in scope, there is some terrific location photography, it's also a film that leans into Wyler's strengths for staging intimate two-person scenes. For what turned out to be his last great success, was there enough Wyler here for you, or was it hard to think of this as anything other than Streisand's show?
We're back, baby. Me and Wyler, we're back after two disappointments for me. And
things were touch and go there for a while.
Yeah. In answer to your question, I mean, it's both. We get to eat our cake and have it too here with Funny Girl. I will note, it did occur to me early on watching this film, maybe first 15, 20 minutes, having previously watched Ben-Hur. The notion in my head was, I wonder if Wyler ever thought to himself, how did I go from a Roman chariot race to the roller skate rag? But any fear that his heart might not be in the material, I'll say, was unfounded, Josh, certainly by the end of the film. And I think there are some specific directing choices and different formal elements we'll get into, but just bigger picture in terms of how much Wyler there is here. Throughout this marathon, we've seen Wyler distill large-scale events, not in every case, but many large-scale events down to these character dramas about relationships, specifically marriages and their complexity. Esther and Judah, to an extent, in Ben-Hur, Kay and Clem in Mrs. Miniver, though they remain stable, I'd say, in an unstable world. All three couples, of course, in Best Years of Our Lives. And I spent a lot of time during Funny Girl thinking about Dodsworth and this seemingly happy marriage that gets tested by, I suppose you could say, the significant character flaws of one of the spouses. Fanny and Sam and Dodsworth hold down the home front while their spouses gallivant around Europe and seek fulfillment elsewhere. Nick is even kind of a hybrid Fran, Omar Sharif's character here. He's a hybrid between Fran and one of the European cads that she is always spending time with. But setting aside any judgment of those characters, these are films about people and their natures and how those natures are tested in a relationship that's undergoing change. So I certainly saw that through line between all of these films. And I don't know if I actually have said this during any of our previous conversations as part of this marathon, or if I just mentioned it on Letterboxd, but Wyler's instinct for which face to favor in two-person scenes is always dead on, whether we're talking about the character and their emotional beats at that moment or who arguably the superior performer is. Here, it's no slight on Sharif at all, who does get his moments as well, to say that Wyler really understands who the camera has to favor. It's remarkable how much of the film is constructed on and succeeds because of Streisand's face and how it is lit and framed. She mentions in passing Theda Bara at one point, and it clicked for me how Fanny is so often shot like a silent film star. Those dramatic profile shots with the slight head tilt. It's a pose I've somehow always equated in my mind with Streisand, even though I'd never seen this film. They imbue her with a gravitas and a status that tell us exactly how formidable a presence she is and how much of a star she is and how powerful she is in the relationship, despite starting as the, you know, young girl who learns from the older, more experienced Nick. And that mirror shot where they first, we've seen a few of these, few well-chosen mirror shots throughout this marathon, where they first consummate their love. That felt to me, Josh, like something straight out of a silent movie in terms of the way it was composed. And those are movies, I think it's fair to say, based on the absence of dialogue, based on the absence of sound, they relied on those faces to do all that work. And even though we've got Streisand's incredible voice here and we've got dialogue and some of it is very crackling, we get some really good lines here. Her face does most of the work.
I think you just found our unique category for this marathon for our awards, and it's best mirror shot, because there are, I'm looking at my notes here, I think at least three fantastic ones in this film. And so maybe when we do our awards, we can spend time on breaking more of those down here and elsewhere, because you're right, it is a striking motif he employs quite frequently. Totally fits that you read this in comparison to Dodsworth and saw these two working hand in hand, because just as I was cool on the relationship in Dodsworth, I think I'm also cool on where this relationship goes and how compelling that is here in Funny Girl. But I did overall really enjoy this picture as well. For me, as a Wyler picture, it actually recalled less the relationship dramas and more Ben-Hur. Honestly, I mean, the scale of this thing is quite immense, not only in the production numbers. I think especially of His Love Makes Me Beautiful, which is, you know, one of these Ziegfeld Follies production numbers we see on the stage that is so elaborate in the depth of activity going on in the stage and how the camera is used there. Or how about The Swan, another number where the camera actually, it sweeps over the stage and then starts to tilt at this really strange off-kilter angle. I don't remember seeing. I'm sure it's been employed before, but in other musicals, that was very compelling. And then we have these other shots, like some of the location stuff that I mentioned, the tugboat passing the Statue of Liberty and the camera swooping over it and coming in, to your point, focusing on Streisand at the bow of the tugboat. And this is the climax of Don't Rain on My Parade. So it was really the scale, both on the sets and outside of the sets, that struck me as I can see how Ben-Hur was in some ways good practice for something like this, even though this is a smaller film in scale. But to your point about focusing on the faces and, you know, knowing which character to focus on, you're absolutely right. It's got to be Streisand here. I mean, that's baked into the concept of this story, but it's also where it has to go. And I think it was incredibly striking where the two things came together for me. Some of these elements about Wyler that you're talking about, and then the scale, is when we get the climactic, her final number, My Man, and the choice of Wyler to just plant his camera, just sit it down with her basically from the shoulders up and not moving it. I think there's one moment where we do cut away to a wider shot, but for most of this number, the film is just on Streisand that close while she sings. And one thing that has become clear throughout this marathon for me is that he was always willing. And this is maybe why he's not like considered an auteur in the same level as some other filmmakers of his era. He was always willing to let his stars be the star. As smart and subtle as his camera choices are, I think that was his priority in almost all the movies we've seen and some others we've seen outside of the marathon. And so in some ways, maybe he was the perfect choice to direct this movie where it was all about Streisand and focusing her talents, the what she was bringing to the screen from already being a star of the stage and already being, you know, a Grammy-recognized recording artist, and helping her to make that transition to the big screen. Wyler may have been the perfect person at this point in his career because he could handle the scale and he knew the intimacy. And I think it's fitting that that's where this movie,
I agree,
that movie ends, with that intimacy right there in front of the camera.
Yeah, I'm on board with everything you said, Josh. And I do overall take your point about scale, especially when it comes to that Swan Lake sequence, which is a dazzler with the camera. It does unfortunately stand out, though, as maybe, at least for me, the only highly unsuccessful song in the entire piece. That performance there, and it's not so much her performance, though I didn't care much for it either. That song itself, that number that Streisand performs there, I thought was bad enough, Josh, that I almost thought it was trying to be intentionally bad. And it was setting up the fact that as things were crumbling a little bit on the home front, it was also affecting her choices and the performance of her musicals. And maybe her star was dimming a little bit. And so when we go from that to that scene, and here again is a great framing choice by Wyler, Streisand, like the jilted wife or mom waiting up for the the teenage boy who's done wrong or the teenage girl who's done wrong, waiting up for them to come home when they didn't make it in time. There he lets the camera just be in long shot on Nick's face, the guy feeling all the shame, who's under attack, and yet we never even see Streisand's face for most of that sequence.
Yeah, she's shot from behind.
From behind, and you see she's got her cigarette up in the air in a very dramatic pose, and we're watching him, and we're watching him squirm, not unlike how he was squirming a little bit ago at the poker table. He picks up the newspapers and starts reading from the reviews, and I thought for sure he was going to read that these were her first negative reviews. I couldn't believe how bad that song was. No, it turns out everyone went for that as well. But going back to the intimacy of it, some of the moments that stand out for me, and this one's a non-musical instance, Josh, but it's around this same time. It's a few scenes just after this. And here's Wyler's genius for staging and that innate understanding of where to put the camera. It's a three-person dialogue where we've got a friend of Nikki's making him a proposition, a business proposition, and he's kind of in the background, and the other two characters, I think, are more in our foreground, Streisand and Sharif. And it all seems a little bit too good to be true. And eventually, Nikki is picking up on this fact. And the exact timing of when Wyler cuts to a three shot, right at that moment where the character Omar Sharif is putting together, just as we, the audience members, are putting together, that she's part of this, that it's too good to be true because basically she's bought his way in. He makes that a three shot, and he makes it a case where Nikki now is not separate. He's not the businessman getting the one-on-one business proposition. His wife is right there joining him in the frame because she's trying to support him. But of course, we know this is exactly the wrong thing that she could do for him in that moment. And then there's an earlier moment where that same type of union is really noticeable, and it's a happier moment, Josh. It's when they're in full bloom of discovering their love for each other, and they're on Henry Street, and she's performing People Who Need People. The elegance of that camera that does feature them in a wide shot. We see a little bit in a two shot, but then there's a good portion of the middle of that number that's just favoring Streisand as the singer, kind of doing her solo. And it culminates with the camera elegantly moving around her, and it winds just to the other side to reveal Nick watching her. And of course, it being Wyler, it's in that deep focus. So we can see him almost as clearly in that frame, watching and adoring her as we see her performing. And that cut, and it's not even a cut, it's again, the camera movement engulfs or, you know, brings Nick into that frame with her, joins them together at the exact moment of the song where she sings with just one person. You know, the camera mirroring her emotions in that moment and kind of foreshadowing the rest of that film. The next full minute of that number is the camera, no cut, just that deep focus two shot on the two of them inhabiting the same space.
Yeah, as their love is in bloom, it's some of the best portions of the movie for me. There's another wonderful shot outside of this lobster shack on a Baltimore pier that's at sunset, and the camera is used somewhat similarly. They're professing that they're in love now. They're not just infatuated. And the camera swings around them and stops just so that the setting sun is right between their faces. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't know. I think it's like location. I'm not positive how they actually got it, but it is a magical moment in a similar way. People. Okay. So you brought up people, and we need to zero in here on the Streisand of it all, because you probably, perhaps, we'll see, and listeners for sure, Streisand fans are going to have to bear with me and trust me that I am on a journey toward Barbara Streisand appreciation, but it is a journey. Okay. I am unfamiliar with her pretty much entirely. I think aside from, you know, late career smaller roles, like, I don't know, Meet the Fockers or something like that, I think my first encounter with her as the star of a film was Hello, Dolly! A couple of years ago. And it took me two viewings to appreciate what she was doing there. I was a little concussed by my first full screen experience of Streisand. She is so much. She reminded me very much like Tom Cruise. She is going to perform you into submission. Took another look at Hello, Dolly, and, you know, came to appreciate knowing, kind of girding myself for it, recognizing the subtle comic choices she makes and all these other elements that she's bringing to her performances. I love, having seen Hello, Dolly, and now particularly having seen Funny Girl, I love the idea of Streisand, which here in particular, to me, seems to match her public persona, right? Is that here is a woman who is not considered a female star in the traditional starlet mode, right? And she recognized that. And she's going to tweak that and yet overcome and take on Hollywood anyway. This is what's happening with Fanny Bryce, just with, you know, the theater. And this is what happened with Streisand in across, you know, across movies, across music, on the stage. And that is thrilling to see someone grab their stardom like that. And my sense is you need to be this brash and bold and emphatic of a performer to make that happen if the odds are against you. What I especially love about Funny Girl is the way this is woven into what makes Fanny Bryce distinct too. She has the same challenges. And when you see something like that, that number I mentioned, His Love Makes Me Beautiful, the Ziegfeld Follies number, the way she, it is this retrograde showstopper that is all about, until she comes out, all about the subjugation of women by way of marriage, right?
Yes.
It's this, I could not believe what I was watching as these various brides come on to announce their submissiveness and their personas.
Yeah. They're only defined by their beauty, and their beauty is defined by his gaze.
I was like, what are we? Is this really what the Follies were like? And then here comes Fanny / Streisand, and she has decided to stuff a pillow under her dress and show up on stage pregnant and completely deflate this whole patriarchal structure that has been staged. And of course, Walter Pidgeon from Mrs. Miniver as Florenz Ziegfeld is furious about this. And then he realizes that the audience is howling with laughter.
I am the beautiful reflection of my love's affection, a walking illustration of his adoration.
So this is kind of like a mirror to me for the sort of way Streisand worked, is to recognizing her, I don't even want to call them limitations, but the entertainment industry's, you know, limitations placing on her and busting through them anyway. So all that to say, appreciate the idea of her and still coming around to the presentation of this idea, which is very, you know, it's just so coming at you. And I don't know. The one thing I'm still struggling with, I'm totally sold on the comic element. I'm struggling with how this works for her romantic scenes. And, you know, we'll need to watch more of her to wrap my mind around this more. But bringing it all back to people, I have always found that song interminable, nonsensical. This is just musical taste. And Streisand's performance here didn't exactly sell me on it as a musical number. And I did struggle once their relationship turned from this romantic comedy dynamic to a more tragic and dramatic turn of events. I did start to lose that sense of her as this volcanic force that even I was finding myself giving myself over to.
Okay, there's a lot to respond to there. and I think we agree on a lot of it, but disagree on some of the fine print, if you will. I don't think I've ever actually heard the song People Who Need People. It's recognizable to me. It's one of the tunes when people are imitating Barbra Streisand, they immediately start to sing. And there are a couple other ones in this film, but I had never listened to that song before. And while I can't necessarily say it's one of my all-time favorite musical numbers, it's a good enough song with a certainly good enough performance. And then with that great camera work, like I already mentioned, it had me, it won me over. I certainly didn't have any issues with that particular number. And the song you mentioned, that sequence, His Love Makes Me Beautiful, I'll just underline this a bit further, because the way I come at it, Josh, is that scene is so crucial to this movie. It is the scene that every biopic about any artist has to check. And it doesn't have to be a biopic, because it could be about a fictional artist too, and we've seen some of those. But in a biopic, it has to be there. That movie that is about somebody great at a thing, right, has their breakout moment. The moment where the entire world says, oh, they're special. The whole movie fails if that moment doesn't deliver and we don't understand that they're special. That breakout performance, whatever kind of performance it is, has to deliver. And in that scene, she's so naturally charismatic as the star. And it isn't even just about a vocal performance. It's about the choices the character makes. As you noted, she's completely undermining the authority of the boss, even if it wasn't planned, as she says it. It just occurred to her in the moment. That's her being true to her nature. She seeks the joke and she seeks to downplay her beauty. And it feels so truthful and authentic to that character. And you have to believe the response it gets from the audience, from the crowd, from the boss. It hit.
I ask my looking glass,
what is it?
Makes me so exquisite.
I knew I was on board for the rest of the film because of that scene. And again, it would be one thing. I just expected it to be, okay, how are they going to show her dramatically, powerfully croon? I already know Streisand can sing. How are they going to convince me, though, that she is an otherworldly talent, that Fanny Brice is an otherworldly talent? And to your point, they found a number that still showcases her voice, but showcases what makes her unique, Brice and Streisand, in terms of that comedic sensibility, and then tying it all together in terms of it being so true to her character,
yeah,
in the film.
And I love how it's set up too. Even earlier, she's at a different dance hall, like a lower rent dance hall at this point. There's a rehearsal number. She's performing with other, you know, dancers. They all have these scarves and all the others are making all these sexy poses, right? And then you can just see that what Fanny is doing is an exaggerated version of that. There's even, I don't know if it's a close-up, but there's a shot where you see her just this ridiculously seductive face. And you can see the seeds of subversion in Fanny / Streisand already there that come to full bloom in, yeah, the number we're talking about.
I did think about this, Josh, watching it. How many young artists, let's say probably aspiring women, who especially saw Streisand as a role model or someone they wanted to emulate, they wanted to be as famous as her, an artist, a performer like her. How many terrible divas this movie might have spawned, who said, but I watched Funny Girl 100 times, and in it, she gets her big break because she doesn't listen to anybody and just selfishly does whatever she wants. Isn't that the answer?
I mean, possibly, but how liberating would it be, though, right? This is where I started to recognize why she is such a cultural force, is because how liberating to see a woman bucking the Hollywood expectations and systems, whether or not you agree that those are standards that should even be in place. I mean, it's kind of, you know, ridiculous to say that this is some sort of ugly duckling or something. But yet, that's the structure that was within. And I had to imagine, especially, you know, in 68, to see someone taking all of that on. And here's where, even though I personally, her performance style may not always, the more dramatic performance style, I should say, not the comic, may not always be to my taste. Here's why I can recognize the power that would have to see someone just operatically blow down those Hollywood doors and kick their way through, right?
Yeah, and that undermining of authority or that subversion, it's there throughout the film, which is also why the arc of this movie and it becoming more tragic didn't bother me at all, because of the way they tie together this dueling part of her personality and that central conflict that's established in terms of being the funny girl and not being the beautiful girl, not living up to the audience's expectation. that tension, or the industry's expectation, that tension is the thing that carries this thing throughout. And I can imagine, going back to the original question here, there could be so many different versions of Fanny Bryce's story made. This one, I understand, is pretty loosely based on her biography. But think about how many different versions could be made, Josh, that wouldn't choose to focus on this Arnstein-Fanny Bryce relationship at all. But that is the movie we get here, at least in terms of its direction from Wyler. I don't know exactly how much it matches up with the musical that Streisand starred in before, but that undermining of the patriarchy, that's there throughout the entire film. Even think about it in terms of something Nick says, where they're discussing marriage and the terms of it. And the movie just takes it as a matter of fact that he says, it's got to be the way I say it or not at all. And he sounds exactly like Florence Ziegfeld there in that moment, right? So these men in her life are always going to be there trying to put these reins on. And I agree that that is one of the real standout elements of this film, is watching how Fanny and Streisand battles against that. I didn't struggle with Streisand as much as it sounds like you did, just in terms of the more dramatic or non-performance scenes. Very early on, where she's playing someone who's meant to be a little bit younger, and she's meant to have a lot of spunk, and she's over trying. The character is trying too hard to break into the industry. There was a moment, Josh, where after we see her on stage, even though she's not even that successful, I thought to myself, wow, this is maybe fitting watching Streisand, that her character, Streisand is such a performer that when she's playing a character, she's not just more expressive, but she's just more naturally expressive in the scenes where she's on stage in front of the camera, as opposed to just in front of the camera. Like, that added element of artifice actually makes her even more at home and even more compelling. But as this film went on, and as I saw all those narrative threads sort of neatly coming together in the tragic, if you will, love story element of this movie, I caught myself, I guess, a little bit surprised, not knowing a ton about Streisand. I've seen The Way We Were, which I do like, and I've seen A Star Is Born 76, which I hate. I can't even really comment on her performance in it. I just think it's a terrible, terrible film. Those are my only two frames of reference. Otherwise, I haven't even seen Meet the Fockers. So that truly is it. I've never watched any of her performances on stage. There's a lot of work for both of us to do when it comes to Streisand. But maybe I went into this thinking, okay, she's going to really hit. I know how much she's going to crush these musical numbers. I didn't expect her to hit me quite as hard with her vulnerability. And what I saw is real subtlety in those more depressing scenes, or the ones where the love story is really unraveling.
How do you think I felt out there trying to be funny? I'm trying to make them laugh. My own husband not caring enough to be there.
I'm sure you didn't let your audience suffer because
You're
of me.
You're damn right I didn't. How do you think I felt afterwards in my dressing room? With people asking me where you were. What could I say to them? That a lousy poker game was more important to you than my opening night?
To hell with your opening night. Why shouldn't a poker game be just as important to me as your opening night? It's my work, and I haven't had a smash hit for a long time. But tonight I was winning, and I wouldn't have left that game for anything in the world, because I thought maybe, finally, at last, my luck had changed.
Here's where we get to Sharif, who, you know, we joked about my take on him in Dr. Zhivago. And, you know, I did not find that to be a performance of great range. I thought he did so much work with, you know, just his watery eyes were doing so much work there. Here, I think he has a bit more range, but similarly, it's pretty limited to his, you've already referenced it, irresistible smile that he carries here as Nick. And let me back up and say, I think he is magnetic, iconically magnetic in Lawrence of Arabia, the stirring conscience of that film. So this is not to disregard Sharif entirely. It's just my impression of these two performances. I did like him here better than in Zhivago, but I did find, because his secret weapon in this film is that adoring smile, and the movie depends on it. When he's giving that to Fanny as Nick, I found him incredibly effective. And I think he's very good at willingly being the straight man to her comic romantic leading lady. I do think the performance fades as Nick's adoration does. And this is separate. I know you were talking about Streisand, and honestly, I'm not saying that she was bad in any way in the more dramatic, you know, more tragic scenes that come later. I'm still talking about my adjustment to her overall Streisand as a force. That's just what I'm talking about. And when the drama calls that force, even musically, to be even more elevated, that's where I'm still adjusting. But I did find things got a little turgid when Sharif had to play this obvious villain fairly suddenly, who, I mean, there are clues, as you mentioned, who is incredibly unsympathetic. It's very clear that he can't be with her if she's more successful than him. And I just thought the movie kind of, the gears started grinding a little bit more when we were going through those motions. Though I agree with you thematically, I'm glad it went there. And right. I was so relieved because it was giving so much time to Nick's struggles here that he still does decide to leave because he just can't handle this. And she does not give up the stage. Like, she makes that choice because it's the choice that this Fanny Bryce and, more importantly, the meta element, this Barbara Streisand absolutely had to make. So the movie comes around to where it had to get. I just think something about the air in it gets, even though it turns more serious, that doesn't mean it has to be less compelling.
Yeah, I can see that. I don't think anyone will probably quibble with the fact that Sharif is way more fun to watch when he's that rogue, when he's the scamp who you just look at and kind of fawn all over, just like she does. And he's so charming in so many of those scenes. And where I'll give him a little more credit maybe than you are, Josh, is to say that even though maybe there's not a ton of range shown, and I do think he is better in those scenes in the first half of the film, I still think he's walking that really fine line of knowing when to completely defer to Streisand and Fanny versus asserting himself a little bit and then pulling back at the right moment. There's a real give and take.
He's a brilliant seducer. He knows exactly how to operate those gears. Yep.
Yeah, I think he is. And I don't want to get too much into the semantics of it. I know what you mean or what you're suggesting, but that's one of the things that works for me about the last half of the film is that I'll go back to the word I've used a few times, their natures. And me having enough of a firm grasp on who I thought both Fanny was at her core and who Nick is at his core, that when he starts to make bad choices, I understand why he's making bad choices and that he's not making them. I don't approve of them, but I understand why he's making them. And it's not because he's all of a sudden just gone bad. He's just a person who is in a situation he's in over his head and he can't stop being who he fundamentally is, which is this gambler who's used to having success.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah, I got more of a, that was good Nick, here's bad Nick feeling. It's not quite that much of a dichotomy, but I do feel like the movie shifts in that direction.
There is a moment when he comes back from a long trip away and she's so excited to see him. She runs across the yard and they've just had some success. And then he says, yes, and I pulled off yet another deal on top of it. And then he says, I think this is the literal quote. I wrote it down. There's nothing to worry about, is there? And talk about telegraphing what's going to happen. It's not just foreshadowing. Like, the movie falls off a cliff literally after the moment he ironically says, there's nothing to worry about, is there? After that, it's everything to worry about. One last little bit. I don't know if I'd ever seen really at least used multiple times in a musical. How about the touch of the singing inner monologue that we get from Fanny? I kind of like it. It's something, well, I guess you could pull it off on the stage only if the character turned directly to the audience. It was basically having that as a private moment with the audience. In the film, the first time it happens, it's when she's repeating his name to memorize it and the movie freeze frames.
That's what Josh, I was going to bring up.
I'm watching at home. I rewound it like, did my DVD get stuck? Did my streaming?
Unusual.
Yeah, it's so unusual. But later, I kind of like more when they used it just as something that was in her head that she was singing to herself.
Yeah. No, that freeze frame, I had the same reaction. And I actually wrote that down because she's looking at his hands. This is the first time they've met. He's come backstage and he's praising her. Yeah. And she's looking at his hands and all of a sudden the picture freezes and we hear her Nicky Ehrenstein, Nicky Ehrenstein, he's got polish on his nails.
Right.
And then it just goes back to live action. I kind of liked it, but it was just so bizarre. And another great Streisand touch is that same scene when she opens the door. And I think it's the first thing she says, just looks at his face and just blurts out, "Gorgeous."
It's like, I love that part.
Okay. Yeah. Like we're really playing with the gender dynamics and the expectations and the ideas of beauty and all it was quite fun.
Funny Girl is currently streaming on Prime and available VOD. One more film to go in the Wyler Marathon. We go back in time a little bit to 1953's Roman Holiday with Audrey Hepburn and Gregory Peck. There again, intimate character drama, but played out on the scale of Rome, Josh, and characters undergoing great change. I'm guessing we're going to experience some more Wyler touches. That one is available VOD. Or, you know what? You could also see it on the big screen with us.
Yeah. You know what? Do that. Come see Roman Holiday at Chicago's Music Box Theater on Sunday, May 12th. Yes, this is Mother's Day. We are going to be there. Michael Phillips of the Chicago Tribune will be there. We would love to see you. We're going to screen Roman Holiday, and then the three of us are going to have a conversation about it afterwards, talking about the film. We're going to record that for the podcast. We're also having a VIP meet and greet beforehand if you're interested in that. So again, that's Sunday, May 12th at Chicago's Music Box Theater. You can get more information on all of this at filmspotting.net/events. And if you want more information on the Wyler Marathon, go to filmspotting.net/marathons. That, Adam, is our show. If listeners want to connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, or Letterboxd, Adam is at Filmspotting. I'm at Larson on Film. Over at filmspotting.net, you can vote in the current poll. We're looking ahead to our summer movie preview. For show t-shirts or other merch, go to filmspotting.net/shop. Filmspotting is listener supported. You can join the Filmspotting family at filmspottingfamily.com. For as little as $5 a month, you can listen to the show early and ad free. You'll also get a weekly newsletter, monthly bonus shows, and access to the entire Filmspotting archive.
In that archive, we did discuss Dr. Zhivago, another Omar Sharif starrer. That was a 2015 Blindspotting review. Neither of us had ever seen that David Lean classic. Did some homework. If you'd like to go back and check that out, again, you can find that in our archive, filmspottingfamily.com. Out Wide, a movie I really want to see, Josh. Challengers, the new one from director Luca Guadagnino. It's a tennis love triangle with Zendaya, Mike Feist, and Josh O'Connor. In limited release, you can see Bill Skarsgård as a deaf, mute instrument of death. Boy Kills World. Humane, the feature debut from Caitlin Cronenberg, the youngest daughter of David, set in a future where environmental collapse has resulted in a 20% shedding of the human population. Okay. Omen, not The Omen, from Belgian Congolese filmmaker Baloji Chiani. Our friend Robert Daniels recommends it, calling it a daring genre mixer. It's playing at the Siskel Film Center. Alien is out for its 45th anniversary. And yes, The Mummy is out for its 25th anniversary. Josh, higher on it than me. You know what? Go have fun. Eat some popcorn. Watch The Mummy.
Oh, thanks, Adam.
I won't judge you. I'll give that to you.
We all appreciate it. Mm-hmm. You're so gracious.
Next week here on the show, we might get to one or two of those other titles, but we are going to focus on the summer movie preview, pitting some different upcoming titles against each other. It's our fully ado new approach to previews here on Film Spotting. We'll see if the gimmick has worn itself out, Josh, after a second time.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Veronica Phillips. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.